is an overview.
We just got the recording on, just now.
Do you want me to repeat?
For the record.
For the record, I'm opening the June 3rd meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reserve Funds. We have a relatively compact agenda, although some people have come here from considerable distance to address this committee. First of all, I'd probably like to put a couple of things on the record. This task force started very late. This is the second meeting it has had, actually, in the interim. It looks as if we are probably going to have to put in some kind of an interim report to the legislature and then determine how we proceed after September. We already know that there are a number of conflicts during September days for people, so if we were going to meet again before the end of the year, it would probably not be during legislative days, or it would be during the December legislative days. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Teresa, who's going to, since it's been like 6 months since we've met, who's going to do an overview of the responsibilities of the task force.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. This is the same memo you'll see attached that we provided in January, but again, since we have not met since that time, we wanted to just quickly go through that again. So, and also, as you hear the presentation, I think it's helpful to be reminded of what the duties of the task force are. So obviously, one of the major duties is to review current provisions regarding our current reserve funds, primarily the Education Stability Fund and the Oregon Rainy Day Fund. And at the end of this process, submit a report to the legislature. And again, Co-Chair Devlin talked about technically that is to be submitted by September 15th. But in that report is also that you would be making recommendations around any practices or constitutional or statutory changes that you would like to see to enhance the effectiveness and performance of the funds. In terms of looking at the funds, there are a number of items that were outlined in the bill to determine how best to make those changes. So things like the economic volatility of the state, the appropriateness of the current limits, and the uses of the expenditures of those monies, the source of the deposits, a number of items, and those are all listed here in this item. And again, it has been attached on OLIS. Again, reminder of those is also because I think it is a good segue into the presentation you're going to hear today from the members of the Pew Foundation Charitable Trusts. Who have done some preliminary work for us and with us. We've had a number of good conversations and provided questions to them that they responded to, which helped us think through things. And then they have now prepared a presentation for us today, really around the economic volatility and then some of the specific responsibilities of the task force. And unless you have any questions for me, I will turn it over to them.
Okay. Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Steve Bailey. I'm a senior researcher with the Pew Charitable Trust.
My name is Bob Zarednik. I'm a director with the Pew Charitable Trust.
And before I get started, I just want to kind of talk about what our team is focused on. We're focused on managing state fiscal health by conducting research on common fiscal and economic challenges. And as we've looked through all these issues, we quickly identified one particular issue or nuisance, for lack of a better word, that's hampered a state's ability to effectively long-term plan a number of areas, and that is revenue volatility. And so over the past 2 years, Pew has released three research reports focused on helping states manage the revenue volatility and specifically improving their rainy day fund policy. And as part of our research, Pew has identified best practices for making deposits, withdrawals, and determining an evidence-based savings target for state reserve funds. And now later, Bob is going to talk about these best practices and how they relate to the goals of the task force that Teresa just outlined. But first, I just want to give an overview of revenue volatility in Oregon and how it compares to other states. And I want to start with one of the underlying drivers of volatility. And before you can talk about tax volatility, you need to take a step back and analyze state economic fluctuations. And so to do that, I want to show you a picture of state economic volatility over the past 25 years. There are a lot of different ways to measure economic growth, and one of the measures we like best is called the coincident index. And This index combines non-farm payroll employment, average hours worked in manufacturing, the unemployment rate, and wage disbursement into one single index. And so here you can see the annual changes in total U.S. state coincident index. And notice a cyclical pattern, economic growth in between recessions, with drops occurring where you would expect, especially during the Great Recession in 2008. And now next is the graph of Oregon's economic growth compared to the U.S. The overall pattern is the same, but the peaks and valleys are more intense. And this might not be a surprise to you. Oregon and the West in general are a little more dynamic than other regions. So even before we're considering the tax policy, Oregon's underlying economic fluctuations are more volatile than the nation as a whole. And so does this pattern hold when we look at tax revenue? Well, this is a graph that looks at total U.S. tax revenue fluctuations, basically combining the revenue numbers of all 50 states. And again, much like the economic data from the last slide, you can see the cyclical ups and downs of the revenue cycle. And now let's graph Oregon's total tax fluctuations. It has the same general cyclical pattern, but look how much more volatile and jumpy these changes can be. So how does Oregon's revenue volatility stack up to other states? Well, by analyzing the points on this graph, we can tell that answer. Pew has measured the volatility for each state's total taxes by calculating the standard deviation of these annual revenue changes. So we all know that Alaska is volatile. We also think of big states like Texas, California, and New York as having volatile revenues. So how does Oregon stack up? This is a bar graph that shows that standard deviation or volatility score for selected states' total tax revenue. Oregon has a volatility score of 6.2 percentage points, and this just means that revenues typically fluctuate between 6.2 percentage points above or below the average growth rate. And this puts Oregon 16th most volatile in the nation by this measure. You can see it's more volatile than states like Texas and New York, less volatile than California and Wyoming. But before I go forward, I do want to make two caveats about what you're seeing here. And first, 16 might not seem all that high, except once you start removing oil and gas tax-reliant states like Alaska and Wyoming from the list, you realize that Oregon is actually one of the most volatile states that doesn't have severance tax as a major tax stream. And second, I said this measures total state tax volatility. And we look at total tax volatility because it's easy to compare states. However, thanks to Oregon's Office of Economic Analysis, we have data on the general revenue fund only, which is obviously supported by the Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund. And so looking at that data, Oregon's general revenue fund volatility score was 7.6%, which would rank it 8th on that list, including the severance states. And so
We have a question.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was always under the impression that Oregon was the most volatile, so this is somewhat of a relief. But when you explain the oil and gas, okay, I understand that, but California and Florida are more volatile?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to measure volatility, so I'm sure maybe another measure it would rank higher. This is, again, just the standard deviation way of looking at it. And then I think, again, when you look at just those general revenue fund dollars, kind of the ones that you guys see and deal with on a regular basis and can appropriate, that's where you see even more volatility, where you're ranking up there with, like, New Mexico and states that really have a lot of really high volatility, mostly due to their severance tax. Yeah. But there's a lot of different ways to measure it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
In California, the composition of income is very heavily reliant on capital gains, more so than Oregon, and that drives a lot of their volatility as well. So that's another thing to think about is sort of what are the components of income in each of these states.
Absolutely. And so for this next graph, I just want to look at composition of the state's general revenue fund over the last decade. And as you likely already know, and as we kind of alluded to, you're more reliant on personal income and corporate income than most other states. For example, in California, they rely on personal income for about 50% of total state taxes. In Oregon, that number is closer to 70%. And combined, when we're just looking at the general revenue fund, personal and corporate income made up 94% of general fund revenue in 2015. I just want to caveat that this tax portfolio choice isn't necessarily a bad thing. States obviously create their tax policy around a number of social and economic considerations. But just what does this volatility mean for Oregon? And first, it just naturally means that revenues are going to be highly correlated with personal income taxes. Here you're seeing the total annual tax fluctuations for Oregon all the way back to 1950. And now I'm just going to add the personal income tax component next, and just look how closely that this is going to track with the total taxes. And next, I'm also going to add corporate income. And you can see how much more volatile it is than personal income. But because it represents a smaller share of total taxes, it kind of has less of a pull. So what does it mean to be reliant on personal income? Well, just generally speaking, it means your revenues are going to be a little more volatile than states that rely only on sales tax, per se. It also means you're going to see more sustained periods of growth than a state that's more reliant on severance tax, which can experience a lot of peaks and valleys randomly from year to year. And obviously, everyone here is aware and has been directly affected by the problems associated with volatility. Just imagine how much easier it would be budgeting if revenues grew by the exact same amount every year. Not only does volatility make forecasting revenues impossible accurately, 100% accurately, it also creates structural imbalances. We see a lot of states using above-average revenue to fund recurring expenditures, only to see a budget gap when revenues inevitably decline below that average. And that's why reserve funds are so important, and that's why these task force questions are important. So how should you think about the questions that have been presented? Here you can see the determinations that the task force is to make divided into different fund design categories, fund size, deposit rules, and withdrawal rules. And just for the remainder of this presentation, I'm going to hand it over to Bob, who's going to walk through each of these categories. He's going to expand on what Pew has found as the best practice for all these categories in the hopes of providing some guidance as the task force considers those questions.
Before we start with Bob, I just wanted to make sure everybody saw that.
Oh, wow.
This is our in-house chart. We matched up our general revenues with Swiss Alps, and they actually come kind of close.
That's pretty good.
So, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to...
Is that for sale?
Yes. I like that. Do we want to pause for questions, or should I plow ahead?
Let's see if there are any questions at this point.
We good? Okay. Yeah, and feel free to interrupt if you have questions. So thanks so much, Steve. So I'm going to turn to these sort of elements of the charge of the task force, starting with fund size. And the question of whether funds reflect the economic volatility of the state relates both to the current balance that you have as well as the maximum balance that are also known as the rainy day fund caps. And we get this question a lot, you know, how big should our rainy day fund be? But there's really no one-size-fits-all answer to that question. Oregon, along with 42 other states, has put limits on the size of their fund. The Education Stability Fund is capped at 5% of biennial revenue, while the Rainy Day Fund is capped at 7.5%. What this graph shows is the combined size of those two funds over time, and it also shows how that relates to the cap that was in place at the time. The jump in 2008 corresponds with the state's creation of the Rainy Day Fund, so you see an increase in the balances there. But you can also see that the balances have never reached the cap, and that's not necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. You want to set your fund goals based on, based on the evidence of what your volatility is. You don't want to save too much because every dollar saved is a dollar that can't be used for other purposes. But also, saving too little can leave you vulnerable to fiscal crises. But despite the importance of setting the right size, our research has found that only 5 states are using evidence to determine fund size, things like revenue volatility and forecast error. We're sort of working to try to get more states to bring evidence into that conversation. So how should lawmakers think about setting a savings goal? So first, Oregon should define the Rainy Day Fund's goal or purpose. Figure out why you're saving. In other words, lawmakers should decide what is rain in Oregon, such as whether balances should cover any revenue shortfall or only more severe recession-driven shortfalls. Second, lawmakers should determine a desired level of coverage, and that means just thinking about the severity of possible recessions the fund should potentially cover. Are you trying to cover the next great recession? Are you trying to cover sort of the typical recession that's happened over the last 50 years? You know, what is your, what's sort of your risk tolerance? And then finally, lawmakers should address the length of time a shortfall should be covered. Are you trying to cover an expected one-year shortfall or the more typical recession that sort of impacts state budgets for 2 to 3 years? So those are some of the questions to think about in figuring out your fund size. And now I want to sort of turn to states that have actually kind of put this into practice. So using the criteria I just outlined, Minnesota has developed an innovative evidence-based approach to identifying their reserve savings target. So their method uses the observed volatility of the state's revenue portfolio to inform how much the state would need to completely offset various revenue downturn scenarios. So we took that methodology from Minnesota, and we worked with Wyoming, where the state's revenues are heavily influenced by volatile energy prices and mineral extraction. So the estimates you see here reflect the percentage of biennial revenues needed to completely insulate against increasingly severe revenue downturns. And this is an analysis we could do for Oregon if you found that to be useful. So basically, what this is showing is similar to an insurance policy, the higher amount of protection you want, the more the state has to save, or sort of you have higher premiums if you're trying to protect against more risk. So here, if Minnesota only sought protection against half of the possible downturns, they would only need 2% of biennial revenues in reserve. However, the policymakers in Minnesota have decided they want to protect against 9 out of 10 possible downturns, so essentially all but the most severe downturns. And based on that, they set their savings target at 4.8% of biennial revenue. For Wyoming, as you can see, revenues are much more volatile, so they have much, much higher savings targets. Wyoming, interestingly, kind of falls in the middle of in terms of volatility of Wyoming and Minnesota. So presumably, those percentages would probably fall in the middle, but we'd have to do the analysis to kind of figure out where that would fall out. So in order for our organ type, and also then there's the question of kind of some of these assumptions and policy choices. So for Oregon to identify how much it should save, you first need to determine how much protection you want. For example, you know, Minnesota looks for their reserves to cover 90% of possible shortfalls. Where would Oregon fall on that? Similarly, Minnesota's target provides protection against a shortfall of only one biennium, whereas Wyoming has experienced much longer downturns, and they're actually trying to protect against 5 or 10 years of potential downturn. They've actually had downturns that have lasted 10 years because of oil prices. So next, I want to talk about another important aspect of fund design: the deposit rules.
Can I clarify one thing?
Sure.
In terms of protecting yourself from a downturn, you said that Minnesota defined that as, in a sense, covering 90% of their shortfall. I think most of the discussions in this building have been that in our reserve funds, there wasn't an expectation that we would somehow not be making any cuts
right. In
programs. But has there been a variance going away from Wyoming, which is actually an exceptional
case, very exceptional, yep.
Because of their severance tax, I believe Wyoming has a huge amount of their funds actually go into a permanent reserve fund
that
is constitutionally protected because they recognize the long-term volatility of their revenue sources.
Right.
But have states set different standards? I mean, you said Minnesota's 90%.
Yeah, so there's two ways to think about this. There's the Minnesota trying to cover 9 out of 10 possible recessions, which is sort of from the least to almost the most severe, and then they want to cover 100% of that downturn, versus a state like Virginia, where they only take out 50% of their rainy day fund in a given year, which means they're not willing to sort of drain their fund entirely. They know they're going to have to take other actions to sort of balance. What's interesting is for the longest time, there was this notion that, you know, a 5% reserve was adequate. And that was always sort of an urban myth. There was never any evidence behind that. It's now evolved to where you realize every state has a different, probably maximum need for what it's going to be, but that's also probably not politically feasible. So you can sort of calculate based on this methodology, you know, we want to cover 9 out of 10 possible scenarios for 3 years, which means our fund needs to be 20% of biennial revenues. Everyone knows you're never going to get to that level. So, okay, we know we're going to cover half of it with reserves, which maybe that means you need a 10% reserve, and you know you're going to have to cover the rest with other things. And every state has sort of made, for the most part, most states don't have enough to cover, you know, the full load. The question is, you know, how close do you want to get? 50%, 25%, 75%. And I think that's some of the analysis. We can at least come up with a range of numbers. You can get a sense of, okay, this will help us get to 50% with reserves, and we're going to have to do the rest with other actions. So moving to deposit rules. So some of the most important aspects of rainy day fund policy is when and how states save. Where does the money come from? In Oregon, as well as 18 other states, the deposits are based on a portion of the balance that's left in the general fund at the end of the fiscal year, and this is known as depositing based on surplus. And as I think you all know, in Oregon, the state can transfer the ending balance up to 1% of the general fund appropriations for the biennium. And this is the most common form of savings across the 50 states. It does have a couple drawbacks based on our research. Most notably, a state's ending balance is a result of many factors, such as the forecast, revenue forecast, spending decisions that are not entirely tied directly to revenue volatility. You can have very volatile revenues, but if you have a fairly accurate forecast, you might not have a big surplus, or you can have fairly stable revenues and an inaccurate forecast and have a big surplus. So there's the tide of volatility is not as direct as with some other methods. So the best rainy day fund saving the rules that our research has found sort of try to harness the business cycle by depositing directly based on revenue or economic growth. And this approach to saving calls for states to save deposits, for states to deposit above normal revenue into their rainy day fund. And we refer to this as savings based on volatility. And there are two key benefits for states that choose to save this way. First, they're able to save the most when revenues are the highest.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
How many of these states have a kicker law similar to ours?
No other state has a kicker law similar to yours.
Thank you.
And yeah, so the take a big step back caveat that I'm going to talk about some examples of other states. We've never taken, you know, an example from one state and dropped it into another state. Every state is different, but we just want to give you the range of practice that's happening in states, and then we can sort of talk more about sort of what would make sense for Utah. But that's an important point to make. But the benefits to saving this way: first, states are able to save the most when revenue is the highest, and you also sort of protect. You don't put unsustainable revenues into your budget to fund recurring expenditures, because above normal revenue, sort of the spikes in revenue, can't be relied on from a year-to-year basis. So it's better to save those funds, or at least sort of utilize them for more one-time purposes, as opposed to building them into the base budget. Currently, 14 states have policies and law that link deposits to revenue volatility. Each of these states designed their deposit rule to ensure they're saving at the proper time, given their experience with volatility. And now I'll talk about some of these examples. For example, some states are saving based on overall revenue growth. In Virginia, for example, the policy states when revenue growth is above the average growth of the preceding 6 years, 50% of that above average growth is transferred to savings. Idaho saves annual revenue growth above 4%, up to a maximum of 1% of revenue annually. Other states isolate particularly volatile sources of revenue to save when it is above normal. For example, California's rule links deposits to rainy day fund to the highly volatile capital gains portion of its income tax. California sets money aside in the rainy day fund when the collections of revenue tied to capital gains exceed 8% of general fund revenue. Texas's Economic Stabilization Fund captures growth from its most volatile and significant revenue source, the severance tax on oil and gas, by depositing 3/4 of any revenue above a benchmark year into the fund. And this has allowed Texas to have one of the largest rainy day funds in the country, which stands at about $7.5 billion, or 15% of general fund expenditures in 2015. And then some other states link one-time revenues to other one-time priorities. Utah's budget process includes a calculation of above-trend general fund revenue looking at a 15-year trend. And any revenue above the 15-year trend is considered one-time, and in 2015, legislators directed this revenue towards capital improvements. In 2015, Connecticut passed legislation creating a rainy day fund deposit mechanism connected to its most volatile revenue source, capital gains and corporate income tax, but they also designated a portion of above-trend revenue to help pay down their retirement liability. So now moving to the third component, we've talked about fund size, we've talked about the deposit rules, and now the withdrawal rules. And rules governing how and when the resources in the rainy day fund are used are also critical to an effective policy. Money taken out of the fund during one fiscal year will not be available to balance the books in the following year, so you don't want to take the money out at the wrong time. And you know, you don't necessarily want to paper over a structural imbalance of rainy day fund money if there are some other structural changes that need to be made. So sort of figuring out when the right time to take the money out is critically important. So to help manage fund use, 16 states, including Oregon, have developed conditions for withdrawal. The withdrawal conditions in Oregon represent a best practice because they are established in law and are tied to clear and objective metrics, including revenue declines and declines in employment. Next slide. There you go. However, there's still important. It's still important for you to consider some questions related to withdrawal rules in Oregon. For example, is that 3% decline, is that the most appropriate metric? Do the withdrawal triggers open up too many windows for withdrawal or not enough? There's always room for analysis and additional consideration of these types of triggers. And that sort of wraps up the formal part of the presentation, and we're sort of happy to answer questions and discuss these issues with you further. Thank you.
Question.
Yeah.
Well, one that I have, in terms of a number of those states have their own unique issues. Washington has been under a tremendous amount of pressure in terms even particularly of court orders in terms of dictating their expenditures. Have they modified in terms of how they've been putting money away because they're under court orders to actually expend considerably more funds than they had originally planned on?
Yeah, that's a good question. In 2010, Washington changed their deposit rule to kind of deposit based off of volatility. They said anytime revenues were extraordinary, we would deposit some of that. Now, since some of the most recent court orders, I think they're still trying to figure it out, and I can't speak to any like statutory law changes they've made in the past few years to match those court orders. A lot of states, especially if it's set based on statute, a lot of states we found are kind of just ignore their deposit rule. We found that credit rating agencies really appreciate not only good deposit rules, but they also like you to follow your law. And so that's a consideration you have to make, any state has to make when they are making their rainy day fund rules. Is this something that we can follow? Is this something that we will follow? Because credit rating agencies tend to ding states that don't follow their rules and kind of are creating a structural imbalance.
Do you know of any other state that for one of their rainy day funds in terms of our education stability fund dedicates the earnings from that fund to other purposes and then also dedicates 10% of that fund to a totally different purpose that only recently has actually returned anything to that fund? So.
No, it's funny because this is a question we're getting more and more kind of the interest of these reserve funds, not just rainy day funds, but just in general, kind of the best use for that interest. And I can't speak specifically to what other states are doing, especially with a unique fund like the Education Stability Fund, which funds the general fund, but also is for just education purposes. But it's certainly something we can look into and follow back up with you. I don't know if you know any more about it.
No, but we now have a database with all the rainy day fund statutes, so I think it'd be fairly straightforward to kind of take a look at how are the interest earnings allocated. My guess is the majority keep them within the fund. Probably some return them to the general fund, but we can look into that for you.
I think almost everybody that's here today, maybe with the exception of the representative, was here when it was established. You may have been. I know you were. And a part of it was political considerations of getting it passed,
sure.
Which is not an uncommon consideration
right.
in this building. But
right, you're, Mr. Chair, you're right. This was done in, I think, 2003, when we changed the system for protecting education from the then existing one to the current Education Stability Fund.
Yeah.
And then more recently, of course, we passed the rainy day fund.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing here to me about the growth fund is, whether it's good policy or bad policy to have the growth fund, it's kind of a misnomer to consider it part of the reserve fund, because it's only recently ever returned any funds actually to the reserve fund. Mm-hmm. And it's taking roughly, well, Rocco's in the back there, but about 18 or 19 million out of the reserve fund this biennium. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's almost, you could almost say, rather than saying you're dedicating 18% of lottery revenue to this, it's actually 16.2, but you could just say you're designating 16 and then just let the legislature decide if they want to change the law or change the Constitution and dedicate 2% to this growth fund.
Right.
But it's kind of a misnomer to look at it as if it's part of the reserve fund, because it really isn't.
Well, it is, if I could, Mr. Chair, it has always been a long, the expectation always was that it was going to be a long-term investment fund.
Yeah.
And that, and it's only been, what, 12 years, 13 years. I wouldn't be at all surprised if it starts returning better, but maybe not for a while yet.
Yeah.
Okay. This is one of those funds where you may not make any money at all for a long time, and then you get one big event, and all of a sudden it pays for everything and then some.
We're waiting for that day.
That's right.
It may be that day. I mean, you and I didn't decide that we should set this fund up. We might have done it differently.
Was the purpose of the growth account to generate interest revenue?
No, I think the purpose of the growth fund was, there's always been this underlying discussion about putting more of our investment dollars into Oregon-based businesses.
Economic development.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the Oregon Investment Council, which invests all of the state's funds, basically, in a sense of deciding who invests them, they have broad fiduciary responsibilities, so they have to go to where they can get the greatest return.
Right, yep.
And in many cases, that hasn't been
inside,
in Oregon.
In Oregon, right. Right.
Yeah, this little fund has been limited in exactly the way that we thought our major investments funds would not allow for the kind of support that some Oregon businesses need. And as you're probably aware, the treasurer has been complaining for some time that we don't, while we do reasonably well with early startup, we don't do so well with the next run out for businesses. And that this fund might get used for some of that purpose through venture capital system.
Yeah. Which is highly risky and...
Right. High risk, high reward.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. But you don't want to spend the pension money on it.
Well, it's funny you say that. On the long plane right here, I read an article about the pension director in Alabama. Alabama's pension invests more in state than any other. It's like 14% of the assets are invested in Alabama. He's been in the job for 40 years. And he's sort of untouchable, but there's a question now about whether that's maximizing returns. I mean, literally, there's buildings all over the state that were built by the pension fund. So it sounds like you've set up a different mechanism, a little more controlled mechanism for some in-state investment. But as you say, that's not savings.
Yeah,
it's a separate policy purpose. And as long as everyone's clear, that's what it is.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to go back to talking about the factors deciding how much you cover from a standpoint of reserves. And so I appreciate and understand the number of years or biennium you want to cover, but I'm still confused. And what are the other factors in there besides just time that impact that?
Yeah, so, and there's a lot of fairly complicated math underlying these numbers that a colleague of mine who has a PhD understands better than I do, but the gist of it is that there's sort of a spectrum of severity of recessions. I mean, the Great Recession being sort of the worst, and then you can think back to maybe the early 2000s, somewhere in the middle, and maybe and you can sort of play the 5 out of 10 scenarios. That basically takes you to, like, you would cover the average. You basically model what does an average downturn look like and what does it do to revenues.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're willing to sort of say, yeah, we're willing to cover you know, a three-year average recession, then this is how much we need to save. And then Minnesota said, no, we don't want to just cover the average. We want to be prepared for 9 out of 10, which is basically like maybe right up to the Great Recession. So very severe recession that lasts 2 years. So that's going to impact our revenues more than maybe the average recession over 1 year. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's the more severe the recession, the more your revenues go down, so then you have a bigger hole to fill. So it's just a way to sort of estimate how big that revenue decline could be, depending on the severity of the recession.
But is not then, and I appreciate understanding that better about, you know, the length of the recessions then, but then the volatility part, especially in Oregon, is how long it takes, besides how long the recession is, how long it takes for our revenues, especially since our revenues are based on
income,
so much income tax,
right,
how long it takes them. So that's another factor that has to be put into
this. Yes, and the way we do this model is we use Oregon-specific data. So we sort of take a long trend look to say, when a typical recession hits Oregon, how much do revenues decline? When a really severe recession hits Oregon, how much do revenues decline? And then you can say, if you wanted to cover that whole thing with just reserves, it would take, you know, 15 or 20% of your biennial revenue. Or you could say, no, we want to try to cover half with reserves and half, we know we're going to have to do other things. But so there's, we can sort of run these numbers in different ways for you, at least to give you a sense of here's what the math says, and then there's the politics that, you know, factor in as well.
Yeah, if anything, it's good to have a starting point right now of these are the number of reserves we have, and this is how much it would cover right now today. It's just a good reference point. Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Do the states, in terms of trying to determine what they would need to cover these periods of time, do they look at what happens to their expenditure needs during a recession in terms of, well, normally human services expenditures go up?
Right.
To be honest, expenditures may not go up, but our enrollments go up in our universities and community colleges, because people can, if they can't find a job, many times they choose to go back to school or
right,
go to school or go on to graduate school. And I actually advised a whole group of students to go on to graduate school a few years ago because there were no jobs.
Right.
A lot of them took your advice.
Yeah, so we have focused on revenue volatility. There are other ways to do what's called stress testing, where you look at both the revenue impact and the expenditure side impact. And a lot of that's driven by Medicaid. I mean, Medicaid is directly tied to the economy. When unemployment goes up, Medicaid expenditures and its entitlement, so there's not, you sort of have to deal with that. That's not something we do, but that is something other folks have looked at. It's something we could, you know, try to take into consideration, you know, what happens on the spending side in addition to the revenue decline.
Any additional comments or questions? And obviously we have copies of all these. Is Pew committed to doing, well, not unlimited, but any additional research that we may need?
Yep. We are indeed.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming here today.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
Look forward to working with you more.
The last item on the agenda today is sort of looking at the future. And the reality of this is that given all the circumstances that we've had, we've only had two meetings of actually this task force. And I already know that there's quite a number of conflicts for people in September. So, and I also know that we have to at least do a preliminary report to the legislatures due September 18th, I believe. 15th. And so I think we have enough so we can do a preliminary report. But I think it would be good for the co-chairs of this committee to meet with the revenue chairs. Sometime in the next month or two and decide the future of this. And maybe if we're going to continue to meet to decide literally what decision points we need to make to be able to make a final recommendation to the legislature.
If I may ask, what is your hope?
My hope is that we could actually come up with some, if there are statutory or constitutional changes needed to our existing reserve funds, that we get some agreement on what should be proposed there. If there is some necessity in creating additional revenue streams to the reserve funds, that we get some agreement there, and that we can actually get something done to some degree before session, but some of it may have to occur during session. And we're probably looking at maybe some things being considered in the 17th session, but others being considered in the 18th session. I think it's going to go on that long. But I actually think it would be better for this group rather than meet like this. I've done this with a couple of groups, actually, is to meet maybe up in one of the judiciary rooms, meet around a table where you can actually talk, not in this sort of formal atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And maybe have the two revenue chairs and the two co-chairs of Ways and Means meet and basically not make decisions for the group, but decide on sort of decision points, because we could sit here and discuss this for the next mm-hmm. 6 years, actually.
I think we probably have.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, and if I could,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, the questions you're asking are extremely complex. They involve all the fiscal issues that the presentation presents today, but they also present a bunch of political and practical problems. I assume you are caveating what you say with a statement which I'll make and see if you agree. This is a complex issue. It's going to take a great deal more work before we can get to the place you'd like to get to.
Yes. Okay. And I don't think actually that sort of formal meetings like this is still public.
Still public. Yeah. I'll make that clear.
Still public meetings. But where people can actually talk about issues. I mean, this is good for receiving information. It is not actually particularly good for actually, starting to at least lay some of the framework to actually make decisions.
And could I make an additional suggestion that we could meet much more frequently if we were able to figure out a way to do it using a webinar format or a telephone format, so people didn't actually have to travel.
Yeah, there's.
I attended a meeting last year, for example, at 2:00 in the morning, Italian time, because I was in Italy.
Yeah.
Well, I think that worked fine.
The only thing we have to be careful of, and I'll put on my other hat as the chair of the Oregon Transparency Commission.
Mm. Yeah. Oh no, they need to be public meetings, and we need to figure out how to make that so.
Yeah.
I think what I hear is we should meet in Italy.
Yeah, if I think that is what you heard.
Yes.
I think, well, Italy's not Greece, so it hasn't had that level of fiscal problems. Okay, so I think that concludes our work for today. We'll come up with sort of a preliminary report, circulate it to people, and then we'll meet with the chairs of the revenue committees and the co-chairs of Ways and Means and try to decide on some decision points and come up with a work plan for the remainder of the work.
Okay.
And with that, thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
So you're...
Thank you.